So first of all, big thank you to the Center of Human Rights and to the Jean Monnet Chair, and also to Leonce Beckemans, who invited me to come here. I'm really very honored and very happy to be here. And I hope, I didn't know that there were so many students coming also, I hope that you students are aware that you have quite a gem of a little center here. And so there are seminars organized on and on, so I would really suggest if you can to really participate. And actually, in order to start to think what I could contribute, I have had a little look at this book that all of you have to have a look at, which is the proceedings of the conference that we've been talking about this morning. So have a look, I will pass it around. You have it probably in your library. And I will just pass around three other books which I will give you for your center, because what I will only be able to share with you here is a skeleton of a very more complex approach, or in a certain way, let's call it rather seeds. You know, it's a little more alive than if I say skeleton. In the book that I just passed around, Marco Mastia and Jons Beckemans pointed out a few points which I would just like to say as a foreword, okay? And then we come to an introduction of what are the challenges that we're facing with human rights and intercultural dialogue. From there, we'll move to some paradoxes. What are the paradoxes we have to deal with? And then finally, we'll go to a pathway, maybe that we can explore. The very important point was that you mentioned, I think, in your introduction, is that this whole notion of intercultural dialogue is as well an internal European question as an external one. And what is very important is to have a kind of an approach, which you mentioned this morning also, which has to be a model approach, which we have to apply to ourselves, but which may also give our originality in the more global framework. Personally, I'm an anthropologist of law, so I'm between social sciences, anthropology, and law, legal theory, and I have been working on questions of human rights, governance, sustainable developments on the global level. So less on the inter-European level, but more on the global level, in contexts where sometimes these notions like human rights, democracy, state, individual, are not necessarily the notions that are shared by the majority of the populations of the other countries, where the official system is an imported system, is not the autochthonous system. And so this taught me a lot about how to become sensitive to issues of intercultural dialogue, and I also became aware that actually it does have a relevance for what we're doing back home. It's a very complex question, that is what Leonce pointed out, and I would add to this, and it's a very complex question at the same time, it's a very fashionable thing nowadays to talk about intercultural dialogue. And so sometimes we stay on a very superficial level, and we do not recognize, to put it in a very, very small nutshell, that as Robert Vachon said, who was the director of the Intercultural Institute of Montreal for like 50 years, he's talking from a Christian perspective, but he has devoted his whole life to intercultural dialogue. He said, intercultural dialogue is crucifying, but liberating. It's not funny when you start to have, when you take the other seriously, it challenges your own assumptions. And you may witness existential crises on personal levels and on collective levels. And it's only when you do experience this kind of thing that actually you're really starting to have a dialogue. If there is no crisis, you stay just on a very superficial level. But then this crisis is then an opportunity to go somewhere else and maybe to open up new horizons. But I think that this is a very, very important aspect to point out. A second thing is that the whole question of human rights and intercultural dialogue, one of the chapters was on that topic, is linked to other questions, which are the questions of citizenship, democracy, the whole articulation from the most local context, like cities, to the regional, continental, global context. And they also link to many terms like participation, inclusion, dialogue. So although you will see we will start from a reflection on human rights, it will open up little by little to more a general framework or general basis for intercultural dialogue from a European context. And so that was the other point that you had in the publication, saying we have some basics where we start from. And probably if you would start the intercultural dialogue, I don't know, from a traditional Indian point of view or Chinese point of view, you may not have the same departure point. But from a European point of view, it makes very much sense to start from the question of human rights, which is our Grundnorm in a certain way. So what is interesting? So now we start to come to the question of what are the challenges, what are the questions. Now, if you take human rights seriously, you're immediately confronted with one big paradox, which is contained in the notion of basically equality. All human beings are equal, share the same dignity. What is the paradox? It is that on the one hand, this points to the unity of humankind, and please be aware that it is not a given everywhere that all human beings are considered as being human. You still have contexts where some human beings are considered less than human or not completely human or whatever. So everything that I'm saying is already starting from these assumptions that everything that looks human, to put it like this, is human. So it points to unity. But at the same time, this unity also implies that we not only have to respect every human being as an abstract human being, but all these human beings do manifest in very, very different ways and have very different cultures, cosmovisions, points of views. So it points also to the diversity. So you have a very big tension, which is comprised in the very notion of human rights, so in the whole notion also of like Western science, trying to make universal science of man and so on, which is this polarity between unity and diversity. And to say things like, just to give a little framework, usually lawyers have a tendency to be more universalist, you know, because they make the systems and try to apply the norms. And the anthropologists are the ones with a tendency to be more relativist, you know, focusing on all the different point of views and you cannot compare in these different worlds and so on and so on and so on. Now imagine the poor me, who is a legal anthropologist, you know, and you are somehow in this in-between and you have to, well, try to do something out of it. So basically it points to two challenges. So the first two challenges are the following one. It's the opposition or the dilemma or the choice between a universalism or relativism. Is there something universal? A universal system of law, a universal system of rationality, or whatever? Can we impose it maybe, or can it be constructed? Or isn't there? Are there completely different world visions which have nothing in common? Cultural relativism, where you cannot even judge another culture, and where you may have, as Selim Abu said it, a shift, you know, from a right to difference, what he called a right to indifference. It's just, okay, you torture, you do this, it's okay, it's another culture, and what do we have to say? So the first question is it possible to move to a pluralist approach? Something which is neither universalist nor relativist, but which recognizes both these poles. And this is a very general question. It's a more theoretical question, if you want, which has practical consequences, but it's a more theoretical question. You do have a second question, which may seem kind of similar, but which is somehow different, which is what is the relationship between universalism and particularisms? What is this about when you have your general theory, your general human rights conventions and so on? How do you translate them into local contexts? How do you apply these global or general principles into concrete local realities? So that's the second question, where the challenge for me would be summed up in the word of pragmatism. How do we manage to think practices? Especially in the continental European legal systems, we have a tendency to very much think about norms, systems. We have difficulty in thinking practices. So you see that we have so these two paradoxes with two challenges, which are pluralism and pragmatism. Now, the context of these questions has changed since, I would say, the 1990s. And actually, I cannot go into the details, but some doors have opened up which allow to address questions differently than before. What is the change? The change is that you had in the 90s two terms, governance and sustainable development, which became more prevalent and which started to complement or sometimes even to replace the talk in terms of rule of law, état de droit. It was a new paradigm. To simplify things, what these two paradigms share is this idea of participation. The very central idea is the idea of participation. Now, what is so interesting when we start to talk about participation is that it is interdisciplinary, intersectoral. It's about all the stakeholders. It's about inclusion. Before you were talking in those terms, When you talk to a lawyer, everything which is not official state law is not law. So you may tell him that his legal system only exists on paper and that it doesn't really apply anywhere in, I don't know, Congo or Zaire or whatever, ex-Zaire. But he cannot do anything with it because it's not law. Now, at the moment where participation came in, well, suddenly you have to take care of the stakeholders. You have to take care of what they're doing, what their concepts are, what their world visions are. So you have an opening up, in the best case, I'm not talking about the negative case, we could have a discussion, but we have an opening up towards more dialogical or articulative approaches, which may recognize a more pluralist approach. And in terms of law, situations of legal pluralism. And very recently, the Committee of Human Rights Policies in Geneva even made a report on human rights in legal pluralist orders. So little by little, these things are making their way. But so, what is replaced also is so this idea of participation coming in, and so the universal relative debate starts to be reframed also sometimes in terms of global-local. What is the global-local interactions? And one term that you may hear is glocal. It's even saying that things are not only global or local, but it's all these interactions that we actually try to understand. Which leads to quite some rethinking and refashioning of our more classical approaches. Now we come to the paradoxes. So we see that something new is emerging, although we still have some basic questions, but they get reformulated like in a different way and opening up new spaces for putting those questions. And at the same time, we still try to answer new questions and new contexts with tools that we have inherited from before. Like if I want to use this vocabulary, some people talk about the present situation as being postmodern or transmodern or, well, not modern anymore. But many of the tools, legal institutions, political institutions, are still our heritage of modernity. And this is even down to the very concepts of how we think about diversity. So we'll just say two words about these paradoxes, and then in order to try to see how to overcome them. A main paradox, I don't know if any of you have wondered about this, see, we talk about intercultural dialogue and cultures, it refers for us to diversity. When you say cultures, it's immediately, oh, it's the diversity thing, you know, it's like the pluralism. But actually the word culture comes from the Latin cultura, in the 13th century, which meant the place you cultivated, like the field where you were growing things. And little by little it started to mean the action of cultivating. And then over the centuries it started to take on the meaning of cultivating a skill or a faculty that you have. And around the 17th, 18th century it came to mean, well, somebody who has culture, somebody who is civilized. This was the same kind of meaning. It's somebody who is not in a state of nature. It's somebody who has acquired skills, knowledge, with the importance of reason also. So historically, this notion of culture is actually a uniform concept. There was culture, and then there's nature, and then you have all the in-between, you know, from the savages to the civilized Europeans. But there is no cultures with an S. And the interesting thing is that at the same moment that you have this thrust out, a universalizing of culture, or universalizing of a rational organization of society, and you want to instill this, well, in order to do it, you close down your borders. And that's what we witness in the end of the 18th century and beginning of the 19th century. It's the whole nation states, the European nation states emerging. And you have, I'm cutting things very short, but just to give a little idea, and then you have this idea of national cultures emerging, coming at the beginning from the German approaches, like with this idea of Volksgeist, you know, the spirit of the people, and so on. So you have national cultures, but these national cultures are thought in a very homogeneous way. It's a homogeneous identity, it's a crystallized identity, it's like mini nation states in a certain way. It's not a plural concept as such. So we do have a paradox here, that in order to try to deal with pluralism, we actually use terms which are rooted in a very, very uniform mold. And so we have lots of problems of dealing with pluralism in other terms than collective rights, and as opposed to individual rights, you know, and federalism or whatever. What is underlying this whole world vision, this question, is a whole world vision, which I will just use the words of Raymond Panikkar, P-A-N-I-K-K-A-R, who's really a great intercultural philosopher who spent his whole life, for 50 or 60 years, to try to build a dialogue between Hindu, Buddhist, Christian, and secular approaches. With the question, how do you have dialogue between different faiths? How do you dialogue when it's not just about like some content, you know, but you may be rooted in some very, very different perspectives? And so he makes a distinction. He makes a distinction between what he calls like a dialectical dialogue or a dialectical framework and a dialogical framework. What is the dialectical framework? We're still in our paradox. We try to approach dialogical questions from a dialectical framework. And so then we'll come to the way, and that is where we develop the dialogical approach. The dialectical framework is a framework, a little like you were pointing out, where we do consider that we can know reality and the world through reason alone. It's completely objectifiable. And so when we do have a dialogue, it's about, well, two heads think better than one. It's a debate. And it may help us to get rid of inconsistencies and to move closer to truth. We may find out that we're both wrong, but we may never find out that we're both right. This is very useful, very important tool, but it may get very counterproductive if it is not limited to the domain to which it has to be limited, meaning you share the basic assumptions. If you share assumptions, if you have a certain system, mathematics or whatever, and then inside of that you dialogue like this, it furthers knowledge. When you apply the same methodology without even being aware of it, while talking with somebody who does not even share the same assumptions, you will construct things in terms of right, false, inferior, superior, not yet civilized, civilized, or these kind of things, without ever really understanding what the other is actually about. And so that is what Panikkar says we need to complement this dialectical approach, this dialectical paradigm, by a dialogical approach. So he calls even the dialogical dialogue. And he says in the dialogical dialogue, what is important is not so much what we're talking about. For example, in the discussion with India, traditional India, it's not like, do you have human rights? Well, we said, okay, let's say, do you have something like human rights? Well, what do you have? And then little by little finding out what is their perspective? What is their vision on the things? And by doing this, maybe getting aware of my own rooting and my own presuppositions. Because when you're a legal anthropologist, you actually do find some cultures that don't even have a word for law. You didn't even think that this could exist. You know, for you, law was a universal. So little by little, you get aware of your own unconscious presuppositions, which Panikkar calls your myth or your mythos, which are the things that you believe so much that you do not even believe that you believe them. It's not about, oh, I believe this. No, you're not even aware that you believe them. And you only become aware of them when you encounter somebody who is in a different meeting and says, oh no, law, I don't know, what is this meaning? Never heard about this meaning. What? You know? And that is why it's getting very unsettling. Because all your certainties crumble down. You thought that life is functioning that way, and suddenly you're like, oh, it's maybe not functioning that way. So when we put this dialogical dialogue into practice, so there I'm complementing it like with my own things, but let's say the underlying approach would be this approach of dialogical dialogue. Well, you will encounter three or four poles. Very often I teach to my students, I say anthropology of law or a dialogical approach to living together, if you want to call it like this, it's a way, it's a path, it's never ending, it's an attitude, it's an existential attitude in a certain way. It's for those of you who may be interested in Chinese or Japanese martial arts, it's a do or a tao. It's a path. Practice karate do, the way of the empty hand. It's not only a practice, it's a way of moving. So this way moves between four poles, which I'm going now to outline very shortly. First one being alterity, otherness. Second one being complexity. Third one being interculturality. And fourth one being what I call humanity. And actually, I often see the first three poles as kind of three different cultural disarmaments, which is something I think is very important. Let me come to the first point, alterity or otherness. Why is it the first cultural disarmament? It is this idea that you start to recognize that your culture is not the only culture. That your points of views may not be the only universal valid points of views. that you may have cultures, for example, I'm not going into the details, take oral cultures, which don't have writing. Very obviously, in an oral culture, you don't have law thought of in terms of codes. It's obvious. But this does not mean that their kind of law is an inferior kind of law. It's a different kind of law. But you have to recognize this. As long as you don't even have this idea that there may be a fundamentally different way of approaching things, you don't even realize it. Also, the Western culture, European culture, is very anthropocentered. We are centered on the human being. But there's other cultures which are more cosmocentered. Like in some Hindu or Buddhist perspectives, when they talk about human rights, they say, okay, but what about the rights of the mosquitoes and the cows? And there's no difference. They're as much sentient beings as we are. So they're more cosmocentered than only like human-centered. And then you have some cultures which are more God-centered. So Panika also says, like, maybe we should also come to a cosmotheandric enrichment, trying to see, okay, some cultures play out more like the cosmic part, some more the anthropocentered part, some more the divine part. And maybe we can learn from all this, but we have to recognize that there are these fundamentally different choices. So this is alterity. Alterity is also maybe more a structural approach. We try to see differences. It's like taking a photograph. It's like, oh, in comparison to the European, the Chinese are like this. It's a broad picture. It's a bit like ideal types. Now, obviously, the danger is if you only do that, you get stuck into culturalism. You start to freeze people in identities which are not necessarily their identities. Because obviously, every culture is diverse inside and have always been in exchange with other cultures. So how do you move from these pictures, these photographs, how do you move to the dynamics of what is going on? And that is the complexity part, which in legal anthropology, I won't address this question here so much, but which is about taking the processes into account. Which leads us to another question, which again I'm just pointing to: interculturality does not make sense in an abstract way. Even when I'm making intercultural philosophy, it's always located. Who are the cultures in question? What is the challenges here with trying to think about Europe or human rights? So when you started looking at these things in terms of what are the processes going on, what are the stakes, what are the stakeholders, what are the peoples, what are the strategies, well, little by little you enter into the complexity of things. And why do I call this a second cultural disarmament? It's a second cultural disarmament because you disarm the totalization claim of culture. Everything is not cultural. When you talk about human rights, oh, we have a different culture. Well, and what about the economic exploitation? What about the social exploitation? What about the political realities? So it's just this thing, after first having made a little relativist stop of trying to understand another culture and what it has in its originality, to say, okay, now I have understood, I have opened up to it, now let's see all the other aspects and not get caught up in a culturalist perspective. Okay, yeah, I'm almost finished. The third disarmament is interculturality. Why is it not the same thing as what you have already been talking about now? Well, when you talk with another culture, see, I cannot speak Chinese and French at the same time. I may learn Chinese, and then I may translate into French, what I have learned in Chinese, but I cannot speak both of the languages at the same time. So if I have an encounter with Chinese people, this may open up my framework, and when I come back and we talk about it, we may open our window on the world more. But this does not make the window of my Chinese friends disappear. This window still exists. And some of the things you cannot translate from one window to the other window. So how to open up to this fundamental pluralism? How to open up of what is going on in between the windows? And where some people may consider, as we are doing, so important to talk, and another culture may consider it's important to sit together silently. It's different ways of doing stuff. And this leads me to the last part, in which I will conclude, which is the pole of humanity. As I said, the whole thing that I try to share with you very shortly only makes sense in the framework, in a very European framework, not all cultures share in exactly that way, that there is a humanity that we share. And I think there is a big question, as you were pointing out, is questions of responsibilities. We're talking about human rights, so the whole question of like a linked responsibility, but what does it mean, the dignity of human beings? And also maybe trying to open up to this cosmotheandric approach that I was telling about just before. And recognizing, and I think this is maybe one of the things that I'm struggling most, honestly, when I'm in different forums and when I'm trying to teach, we seem to be in a context where we place more and more our faith in techniques, in procedures, in processes, in, you know, transparent governance systems and whatever and whatever, and we lose faith in the human being. As long as we don't have faith in the human being as such, with all its imperfections, we cannot move anywhere. And so I think there's a big need, and I hope that universities will make a little move into that direction, take a firmer stance, to say we need these places of humanism. And you may not get all the answers, but at least you get like a human outlook on questions. And so to finish, just a little story, which I think very much kind of reveals the kind of situation we may find ourselves in when we deal with pluralism and interculturality, which also points to the need to be human in order to approach it. There's a little story of Mullah Nasruddin, who is a figure I like very much. And so one day he was appointed a judge. And so he had the first claimant coming and saying, exposing his case. And so the mullah listens to it, and then he's like, oh, you're right. And he has his assistant who tells you, no, but mullah, you have to listen to the defendant, you know, I mean. He says, oh, yes, you're right. So he starts to listen to the defendant. And the defendant puts his case, and he says, oh, you're right. And the assistant gets a bit annoyed, and he's like, Nasruddin, they cannot both be right. And he's like, oh, yeah, you're right. That's the kind of situations we're confronted with. And so I hope that just like this opening up, there is no abstract, objective, rational, or whatever solution to this. It's a human problem, which will always be there. And I think one of the big things is how to build, I'm using the language, how to build the capacities or to be able to deal with that.